Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 12th of February 2021, and you're listening to me, Simon Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com because I have with me alternative historian Horace for the evening. Horace, how are you doing today?
I'm quite honoured to be called a historian of any variety, so thank you for that. Yeah, I'm doing all right, man. Yeah, how are you doing?
Great stuff, great stuff. It's good to have you back. You're having internet connection problems last week, so we had Professor Edward Dutton on, and that was a good show, but I've been looking forward to talking to you again and getting into our Culture of Critique series. Before we get into that, though, I just want to remind listeners that The Greatest Story Never Told DVDs are now actually in stock. It was a pre-order drive that went on before to just get some interest up, and now the DVDs are actually in stock. So anybody that wants to buy a copy of it and watch it on the widescreen, watch it on their DVD player, the link to it is in the sidebar at the RadioAlbion.com site. It's the TWO Films link. So if you just click that, and it will take you to the publishers that are actually publishing the DVD, and you'll be able to buy yourself a copy of that. And they do seem to be going off the shelves pretty quickly as well. So take advantage of it now, because there's a few times that this film has been available on DVD, and sometimes it's not available for very long before there are problems with it, and we get payment processors gone and all sorts of problems. So grab it while it's there, I would, if I was you. It's a good price, it's good quality. There's four DVDs in the set, and I'm also hoping that Dennis is going to be back with us in 2 weeks, so listeners have got that to look forward to. Horace, is there anything you want to bring up before we get into Culture of Critique again?
Well, I'd second your recommendation of The Greatest Story Never Told. That's how I heard of Dennis, as well as his follow-up film about communism. Was it Communism by the Back Door? Yeah. It's a very, very good documentary. And I really wish Dennis well. I'm delighted to hear that he's going to be back soon. And also, I haven't listened to last week's show with Ed Dutton yet, but I just noticed that it was on Churchill's Headmaster, which is a book that I read just recently. So I'm really looking forward to listening to that as well.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I hadn't actually read the book, but I'm thinking I might have to get a copy now. We're all learning about the public school system, and it dovetailed in nicely with another series I've been doing with Max Musson on The Greatest Britons, where we've been learning a lot about the British Empire. The more I learn about the British Empire, actually, the better my opinion is of the people that were involved in it. It may have been a lot of bankers that were involved, but the actual British people that were involved in it were some of the finest I've ever read about. But anyway, we're going to get into Culture of Critique again tonight. This is part 7 of the series, and this is part 4 on this book in particular. And tonight we're going to be looking at the Boasian School of Anthropology and the Decline of Darwinism in the Social Sciences. And to simplify that, it was basically the falsification of racial science to claim that all races are equal. So they removed race as an explanation for different life outcomes. And this was the origination of the magic soil principle that we've become so used to today. And we'll start with a quote from the book, The Culture of Critique. In sociology, the advent of Jewish intellectuals in the pre-World War II period resulted in a level of politicization unknown to sociology's founding fathers. It is not only that the names of Marx, Weber, and Durkheim replaced those of Charles Darwin and Herbert Spencer, but also that the sense of America as a consensual experience gave way to a sense of America as a series of conflicting definitions. And that was a quote from Horowitz. In the post-World War II period, sociology became populated by Jews to such a degree the jokes abounded. One did not need the synagogue, the minyan, which is the minimum number of Jews required for a communal religious service. The minyan was to be found in sociology departments. Or one did not need a sociology of Jewish life, since the two had become synonymous. And that's Horowitz again. That's a Jew writing about this. Indeed, the ethnic conflict within American sociology parallels to a remarkable degree the ethnic conflict in American anthropology that is the theme of this chapter. Here the conflict was played out between leftist Jewish social scientists and an old-line, empirically-oriented Protestant establishment that was eventually eclipsed. So this was the, at this time, pretty much up until this point, everybody in America was English. 90% of the people in America were Anglo-Saxon, and they had a shared experience of what America was and how America had been built. And then from this point on, it became a lot of conflicting definitions, because instead of saying, well, the civilization that was built in America came from the people that built it, they started saying, well, civilizations come about because they mix with other civilizations that are nearby, and that's where they get their ideas from. They get an idea of how to do one thing from a civilization over there, and they get another idea how to do another thing from another people over there. And through trade, they end up advancing their civilization. And that idea, it just seems nonsense to me, because all the civilizations have really been built by white people. And when we look at these tribes that haven't actually got up to a civilization standard, they've had things to do with these other races and peoples. The black Africans, they came across the Romans. The Roman Empire was in North Africa, and it was in Egypt. It was in Ethiopia, or the land of Kush, and it, by brushing up against these black Africans, the black Africans didn't come up with their own civilization. It seems to me that this was really the time when everything changed from being based on facts to trying to find facts to make your theory fit, rather than looking at the facts to actually come up with a theory. And a lot of this fitted in with this Franz Boas and his political beliefs. He was very much a leftist, very much an activist for leftism. And the way that they took over sociology and anthropology is the same way as we've seen in all the other episodes that we've done on this. There were a lot of Jews that were involved actually as professors, and then the Jews that were involved in the media promoted the same thing and promoted these professors as being absolute geniuses. And eventually there was this consensus that these were the guys that were right, and this was the correct direction that anthropology should be going in. And we'll have a closer look at some of the characters that are involved. But do you want to add anything to that, Horace?
Yeah, I mean, this started, I mean, Boas's sort of takeover of anthropology, as I understand it, started in the 1900s decade or the 1910s, was certainly very successful already by the end of the First World War, from what I've read, and had hegemony over all of anthropology all across America. There was Boasian hegemony established over it by, I think, the 1940s. Maybe 1950. By the time of the 1950s, that was accomplished already. I think it's pretty impressive and remarkable to simply take over, and not only to take over the field of anthropology with a new idea. I mean, you could say that Boas's philosophy was new in a not very complimentary way, but to really invert the whole field, to make it, I would say, the opposite of what it is, of what it was, before, what it was intended to be. Because it is, I mean, what Boas represents, and not only him, and there's been others who've done this since, I'm sure we'll mention Stephen Jay Gould. They are, it's as though they've occupied a space in these sort of, I don't know if anthropology is scientific, but fields of academic study, in order to make them not what they're supposed to be, to invert them, to redirect them to basically the opposite purpose, which, as I think you were alluding to there, was to create pretextual arguments for the already like predetermined conclusion, which is basically what the view that Boas wanted to force upon the world, which is that race doesn't count for anything, with I think it being obvious that his reasoning there is that if you allow whites to think in racial terms, they will assert themselves racially. If you deny them that intellectual, basis or the intellectual freedom, they can be forced and tricked and convinced and various things to act against their own racial interests or to deny their own racial interests while everyone else pursues theirs, which appears to be, you know, the Jewish modus throughout the West in many, many areas, not only these academic fields. So the field of anthropology, I don't know how significant it is. The first I ever heard of it was a friend of mine at uni who her course was social anthropology. There was no such course as anthropology by that time. And that was the first I heard of it. But I think what Boas did in that field really demonstrates the Jewish modus far, far more broadly, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. I would agree. I mean, I never really heard of social anthropology, but I was always fascinated by Amazonian tribes and African tribes. And when I was a child, I used to read books. I think they were called Jungle Adventure, African Adventure, Whaling Adventure. And this guy would go out and he'd have these adventures everywhere. I forget what they were doing, whether him and his brother were looking at animals or whatever. But I was fascinated by the talk of all these different tribes and Papua New Guinea and the cannibals of New Guinea, and I learned that studying them was called anthropology. And anthropology was a science. It was measuring the statistics and measuring the people themselves. And what they were saying was that the way that these people lived, it was natural to them. And this social anthropology says that race is a social construct. And it doesn't really matter if you're measuring them, and that we need to get rid of. And that's what Boas said. He said all the racial science that has gone on in the past, which was measuring the sizes of people's heads, measuring their brains, measuring their IQ, all of that is false, and we'll get rid of all of that, and we'll say that race is just a social construct, and it's all about the environment, and it's nothing to do with nature, it's nothing to do with heredity. If you look at his Wikipedia page, nobody points out the fact that everything that he based his work on has been debunked. It was based on this, I forget her name, Margaret Mead, and she did this false report on this tribe, saying that they lived a utopian lifestyle. There was no war, there was no rape, there was no trouble. And it's all been found to be nonsense. It's rubbish. That's not how these people lived at all. There's no mention of that on the Wikipedia page. And what they did, they said, well, this utopian way that these tribes are living is because they hadn't been touched by the Europeans, because the Europeans were the bad guys, and it was all the Europeans' ideas that brought them trouble, and that's what made them start to go to war, and that's what brought them rape and all of this. And it was the opposite of utopia once the Western ideas had got there. And this Claude Levi Strauss, he's another character that comes into this, and he was around at the same time as Boas, and he was in France. Now, his idea was that Western universalism and ideas of human rights, they're all just masks for colonialism and genocide. And he was actually responsible for stopping the French from measuring all the skulls and taking all the statistics of all the French during the war, which would have been, you know, a fantastic resource on what the French people were actually like. I've got a quote from Kevin MacDonald here about Levi Strauss, Claude Levi Strauss. He says, his writings would soon feed the suspicion among the new left that all the universal ideas to which Europe claimed allegiance, reason, science, progress, liberal democracy, were culturally specific weapons fashioned to rob the non-European other of his difference. So they basically claimed relativism, saying, well, just because Europeans know how to read and write and how to do mathematics, you know, these Africans, they know how to catch zebras, and it's the same thing. It's not the same thing. This whole idea of looking, and they were saying, well, you only think that your civilization is better because it's yours. I mean, and that is disproven by the fact that these peoples from these other tribes, they all want to come to the Western civilization, don't they? If relativism was correct, and it was just as good being black and living in an African hut, and the drumming playing was just as good as having the mainstream media that we have here, they wouldn't all want to come to the white countries, would they? So it just destroys it when you look at it like that. But you got any thoughts on that, Horace?
Well, about the last bit, I think that's exactly why this this canard of Western prosperity or Western wealth now having been, and they always use this same phrase, they can't vary from this phrase, it's built on the backs of or built upon colonialism. Like, so they would say built on the backs of the labor of African people. They literally, like, the people who use this canard to justify both African immigration and this increasing call for reparations as well, i.e. Basically a tax on whiteness or on being white, that phrase that they use to justify these things comes from that idea that you know, that they need to explain why, if you know, why Africans are moving into Europe and into the West, and basically the idea that you're supposed to be left with is that it's them reclaiming what is theirs. And the phrase always used to justify, as I said, is, I can't remember the exact wording, but they literally can't vary from it because it doesn't make any sense. Like, it's obviously just, again, a pretext, right? But this one phrase they always use is something like, yeah, built on the backs of colonialism or something like that. And if they vary from it, obviously it opens up the possibility of people arguing and say, well, what exactly do you mean by that? You know, obviously the people who push this are the very same people who enthusiastically support no platforming so that their arguments can't be challenged, so that they can always only talk to people who already agree with them or obey them. What you said about, like, you know, catching a zebra, I mean, I'm sure you're not saying it disparagingly. These are our necessary skills for people who live, you know, in the savannah around zebras, basically. And it's just, the people of Africa are adapted to live in an African environment. Just to refer to what you said about Margaret Mead as well, I thought that was very interesting. Obviously, she wrote that study on the Samoans where she just simply left out any parts that that made them look bad, made them look brutal and savage. She wrote that a long time ago. I believe that was written in the 20s, that book, maybe even the 1910s. And it was a major success. And what is really, really... a really sorry thing to see is that I have heard in my adulthood, like, obviously nearly a century after she produced that book, I've heard Margaret Mead being lauded seriously, like as a really valuable scholar. So 100 years after a fraudulent, deceitful book, she's still valued because, I mean, this is what I think the Boasian school, also the Frankfurt school, and many other sort of Jewish-led intellectual sort of cults, as they are really, Freud as well, these things rely heavily on links with the publishing industries, right? And the people who can make you famous and give you credibility. So it is closely related to Jewish control of the media as well. I think Margaret Mead's reputation must rely on that because it doesn't rely on any sort of academic quality.
Well, they massively rely upon the publishing industry, and that's a good example there where you're saying that she actually left out all the bits that didn't fit the theory, basically. So it's a false theory because she left out all the bits that would have said, well, this theory isn't actually correct. And 100 years later, they're still repeating it. Boas said, you know, the IQ, you can't measure IQ, it's not related to head size measurements. And that has been disproven so many times. You know, there are 20 or 30 different studies that have disproved that. And you can do MRI scans to see, you know, the size of somebody's brain. We have the average IQs of these other races. And Boas said that all that was junk science. That was all just racist science. So we'll throw all that out. And instead, we'll say that it's all to do with the environment. And all you have to do is just teach them more. And eventually they'll be as intelligent and as creative as the white man. And they don't have that innovative skill that we have. That's why they've never developed these things by themselves. But his idea was all they needed to do was come across these other peoples. And then they would come up to that same standard. And as we see today, that hasn't happened. That doesn't happen. It's like expecting, I don't know, sheep to behave like dogs or cats to behave like deer. You know, you're talking about different things here. The kingdom, we have the animal kingdom and we have the human kingdom and we have different types, different subspecies. That's what races are. They're subspecies. It's a biological category, not a social category. I've got a quote here that is from Wikipedia, and this is Boaz himself speaking. He says, "There are two things to which I am devoted, absolute academic and spiritual freedom, and the subordination of the state to the interests of the individual." And I think that's very telling, because that gives us an idea about how he thinks. The individual is nothing on his own. The individual, everything the individual has comes from the people around him. And if you're part of an ethnic nation and you've grown up within an ethnic nation, everything around you will have been provided by your ancestors. If you're a Jew and you're living within somebody else's nation, they're not your ancestors, and you do see yourself as an individual, and you see everything that's there is for you to take, because you're an individual and you can just move off as an individual to another nation. You can move off to another country when the country that you're in is entering an economic slump or whatever. They can move away. And that's the way they see things. And that's a fundamental difference between the way we see things as white people and the way Jews see things as Jews. They see it all as being about the individual. And that's because they are individuals within a host nation. Can you see what I'm saying there, Horace?
Yeah, although, of course, there's various other things they do that contrast with individualism, right? They're very collectivistic in terms of, well, to the extent and in the ways that that is supportive of their own existence as a community or as a continuing group through history. So, yeah, I mean, individualism is something that, in one way, they preach to us, certainly, like the loosening of families, the loosening of ethnic groups. That's been a useful thing for them to preach to whites. But also, yeah, I see what you mean about how individualism reflects the sort of thinking of a group that's been dispersed generally through history, at least since, the old Jewish kingdom in ancient times was dissolved. There is a sense in which individualism is fitting to a people who either can't or don't want to lay down roots within a society. I do agree with you there. I just wanted to pick up on something else you said as well, that what Boaz did to anthropology, I think, has been done to science as a whole, in the sense that, like, yeah, we need, scientific method can be employed, but it should be employed for basically ideologically or ethnically determined ends. I think that's really what the implication of what he did. And that means science must be diverted away from anything which could conclude that whites are superior in any way. And obviously, in terms of IQ, whites are arguably the best disposed. I mean, the research by, is it Richard Lynn, which has shown that Ashkenazis and Far Easterners tend to be a little higher than Northwestern Europeans. That has actually been modified by another writer, I can't remember, but who said that, well, actually, if you look at the data in detail, it does justify that the whites are top in IQ, in the sense that they've got a great range of IQ uses, whereas Ashkenazis tend to be very, very good verbally at IQ, Far Easterners at maths, but we have a good spread of that and other uses for IQ. So I can see why the IQ thing is something that really needs to be fought against by the anti-white front. And just more broadly, I mean, well, you know, in the last few years, since I really have encountered race realist ideas a lot, I've brought up the importance of IQ quite tentatively, because I'm not that well informed upon it myself, but I've brought it up in groups of friends. And on each occasion, I've either been met with the response that, oh, are you talking about that bell curve thing? And obviously, bell curve is just a fairly vague notion in the mind of the people I'm talking to. And it basically just means like another Mein Kampf to them. I'm exaggerating a little bit.
Seriously.
But the other response... Oh, sorry, go on.
No, I was just saying, seriously. Yeah, I just think, oh, it's a book title. I thought it was a best-selling book.
There's a sort of a third or fourth hand meaning of bell curve, which just means racist book.
Right.
That's what I've encountered. And when I've said to them, oh, by the way, you know, this is a book that was written by like one of the authors was a Jew. He happened to die just before it was released. So that was unfortunate. But the white guy is a very soft conservative, and he's writing, and like, basically his argument is intended to benefit everyone, including blacks. It's about holding society together, as he sees it. So it's not a racist book at all, but it does call for a degree of race realism, which is why it had to be attacked. Yeah. But the other response I've had when I mentioned IQ is just, oh, that's been debunked. You know, just this general, you know, you get this all over social media and all over the place. Just, oh, that's been debunked. It's said about lots of things. One of the things it's very, very strongly said about is IQ. And it's like, no, IQ has not been debunked. Like, IQ is just something that's been fought against because it concludes that some people are far more intelligent than others. And there's a scale of intelligence. And unfortunately, Africans are at the bottom of it.
Everyone has to be somewhere.
Part of the IQ map is the darkest. I didn't make it that way.
Yeah, well, everyone has to appear somewhere along that graph, don't they? And we have to be realistic about it. I mean, there's no point funneling all your resources into the people at the bottom of the graph because they're never going to be able to get to the top of it because they don't have the inherited ability to actually do that. It's all about the sensible proportioning of where the resources go. That's the way that I see it. What you were bringing up there about the individual as well, another side to this is any way that Jews can stop us from associating with one another or forming groups, as we were talking about last week, then they'll do that as well. They don't want the non-Jews to get together in religious groups or to identify as a nation or to identify as anything, because especially if it's religious or national, because it means that Jews can't be a part of it. So they would much rather that we saw ourselves as individual, and they want the state to be interested in the ideas of the individual and not interested in the ideas of the group. And nationalism is the opposite of that. Nationalism is putting the needs of the group first. You put the needs of the nation first. And if you're an individual, you put the needs of the individual first. So one way is greedy, and the other way is charitable and loving, because you're doing things for other people. We were saying there about how the whole of science is now based around trying to prove preconceived ideas or preconceived morality. That morality isn't a white man's Christian morality, it's the Jewish morality. So if science isn't going to prove something that the Jews have decided is good for society, then they're going to try and debunk, well, not debunk that science, but silence it. And that's why they do silence it. That's why they don't come out with a debate. They just try to completely deplatform people that point to anything that shows a reality which is different from a preconceived Jewish morality. And they do have a different morality. They're quite proud of the fact that they do, and they see it as a superior morality. That they are bringing the rest of the world. They are a light to the nations, is what they call it. Tikkun Olam. They're healing the world by turning it in, by molding it in the way they want the world to be, rather than the way that the world actually is. And science is supposed to be about discovering how the world is so that we can then conform ourselves to the world. But this way we think about it now is try to make the world conform to how we want it to be. So we end up with homosexuals having IVF children through surrogate mothers. Not something that could ever happen naturally, but because we've decided socially that's a good thing, I say we, our countries have, our states have, so we go along with that. And all of this is all linked together and really sort of started happening with this Boazian anthropology. I've got another quote here from the book. Boaz's influence upon American social scientists in matters of race can hardly be exaggerated. Boaz engaged in a lifelong assault on the idea that race was a primary source of the differences to be found in the mental or social capabilities of human groups. He accomplished his mission largely through his ceaseless, almost relentless articulation of the concept of culture. Boaz almost single-handedly developed in America the concept of culture, which, like a powerful solvent, would in time expunge the race from the literature, or expunge race from the literature of social science. And when you actually look at him, I was looking at pictures of him today, and you can see he's a real showman. He's just from the pictures, you can see that he's this really zany, wacky character. And you can imagine these other anthropologists and scientists, they were probably quite withdrawn, probably not used to dealing with the public. And then you've got a Jew who as you said there, Horace, they've got a higher verbal IQ, and they've got a tradition of being showmen, and that all combines with this scientific guy who came from other sciences and then decided that what he was going to do was apply his Jewishness to anthropology. And it was his Jewishness. He was quite proud of that, and how he would deal with anti-Semites, and how dealing with the problem of anti-Semitism was central to his way of thinking. And that's something that we see with all of these as well. It's Jews are really obsessed with trying to get rid of anti-Semitism, and not by causing anti-Semitism, but by silencing things, censoring things, taking over ideas, taking over institutions. And that was his reasoning for this, is to get rid of anti-Semitism. So it's like a survival tactic for them. It's the evolutionary group strategy, isn't it? Is to try and stop anti-Semitism all the time. I mean, it is an evolutionary thing that they're doing, but all of these people that we're talking about, they're applying that to whatever field of inquiry it is that they're involved in, and then promoting that to the Gentile culture. So you can see that it is a survival strategy, really.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the response to anti-Semitism, i.e. not wondering or trying to avoid creating it at all, just to discover and try and stamp it out, no matter how much and what level of authoritarianism that requires. I wonder if what we're living in now, the time that we're living in, is one of the most intense and getting more intense periods of that in all of history. I mean, the Anti-Defamation League, the level of power they've got in America and have had for the last century, and I think probably never more than now, is quite something. Similarly in Britain, I mean, the Board of Deputies and a whole range of Jewish organisations basically demanded that the leader of a British political party was removed and got their way. I mean, he stepped down, but they in a way demanded of the public that they reject Corbyn, and a lot of British people, how authentically I can't be sure, but they cited Corbyn's anti-Semitism as a reason for voting against him, which is quite something. And then you got, as Andrew Joyce has written about, you got Moshe Cantor. I believe he's a Russian origin Jew who is constantly campaigning at high levels of the European Union to have all, including the most verbal, probably even the most indirect opposition to Jewish power, all across the whole European Union and anywhere else that it has influence, completely eradicated. So we're talking about the whole Western world coming under the control of people who demand silence and probably imprisonment as things escalate further of any opponents of Jewish power. And just also in terms of the sort of just the Jewish awareness of the anti-Semitism threat, which is not unfounded. There have been real attacks and massacres and so on through history, as far as I can tell. There's one thing that McDonald quotes in Cultural Critique. I can't find the quote now, but he just says somebody did a survey, I think he's talking about the 50s or 60s, just a Jew surveying other Jews and just questions to them. I think he asked just the sole question was, could it happen here? And he said not one of them stopped and asked what was meant by it. They all knew immediately. They all knew that it meant some kind of turning against Jews, some kind of driving out or massacre or both, some eruption of anti-Semitism at any rate. And, every Jew was already primed to address that question directly without having to ask a single question about it. So there's this intense collective consciousness among Jews of all different persuasions in other regards that the Gentile is a threat. And therefore, it's no surprise that people like Boaz, will basically create new fields or subvert and invert existing fields. For his own. I mean, we're talking. I mean, to you and I, to sort of people who are more aligned with Athenian thinking, as I would say, this is like so alien to want to invert a whole field of study for your own ethnic ends. You know, for us, I don't know. Our ethnic thinking is something that comes that we learn, I think, to a large extent, but. Yeah, what we see with Boaz, I think with Freud as well, I think with Stephen Jay Gould as well, and many others at Frankfurt School, absolutely, definitely, Adorno above all, They're very, very consciously acting on ethnic ends. And obviously the frustrating thing, the thing that we need to change is for white people, no matter how much they want to talk about race, they need to at least recognize that others want to pursue their racial interests. And so when you see people like Boas in anthropology emerging and taking over and replacing the very valuable field of anthropology, you need to say, that is a move, that is a Jewish power move. So you don't just take it at face value. You don't start engaging with it in a rational way in the first place. You say, hold on, is this just an intellectual trap? And you say, you know, I'm going to engage in this on the level of what it is, which is a power move by a different ethnic group, a foreign tribe. And the more we do that, the better results we'll have.
Oh, yeah, we have to engage with it intellectually. I mean, the thing is, I mean, you can understand it. Jews won't modify their behavior. Why should they modify their behavior? That would mean that they were no longer Jews, wouldn't it? So they're not going to modify their behavior, but their behavior can raise conflict among the groups that they're living in, because there is this competition for resources. So what they're trying to do is limit the chance of this conflict, and arising from that conflict, you get anti-Semitism. So they're trying to prevent that from happening all the time, but they're not going to modify the way they behave. Whereas the people they live among see that and they think, well, this isn't helping us. This is taking from us and giving to them. This is weakening us. We're losing this battle here. So then the problem becomes, well, you know, how do you respond to that without appearing to be hostile? And that's why you get this intellectual battlefield. That's where it is now. It's the intellectual battlefield. Getting back to Boas here, Boas' views conflicted with the then prevalent idea that cultures had evolved in a series of developmental stages labeled savagery, barbarism, and civilization. The stages were associated with racial differences, and modern European culture was at the highest level of this gradation. So, I mean, this is just objectively looking at everything and saying, well, Europeans are at the highest stage of culture and technology. But oh no, we can't have that, because that isn't equal. Everybody's got to be looked at as equal. He also opposed research on human genetics. So he didn't just not want us to be measuring IQ and measuring skulls. He didn't want us to be looking at DNA, because he knew that was going to show there was big differences between the races, which it has done. And the guy that developed DNA has had his Nobel Prize taken away from him for saying that there is a difference between the races, and blacks do
the
have
sexes
a,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, all these things. Yeah, the difference between the sexes. But the way that he managed to get this passed, by 1915, the Boasians controlled the American Anthropological Association and held a 2/3 majority on its executive board. And in 1919, Boas could state that most of the anthropological work done at the present time in the United States was done by his students at Columbia. And obviously, they weren't all Jewish, that there were Gentiles there, but it was a massive majority of Jews. And that was how they got this passed. It wasn't the fact that it was correct. It was the fact that they had a 2/3 majority on the executive board.
And this is what I referred to earlier. I actually made it sound much less bad than what it was. So they had complete hegemony over the study of anthropology all across the USA by the end of the 1910s. So more than 100 years of full Boasian control over anthropology. And obviously what is declared from America spreads out all across the West and all across most of the world. So that's 100 years of deep intellectual corruption flowing out from Columbia University.
Well, let's have a closer look at some of what was being suggested. Cultural criticism was a central feature of the two most prominent Boasian ethnographies, Coming of Age in Samoa and Patterns of Culture. These works are not only erroneous, but systematically misrepresent key issues related to evolutionary perspectives on human behaviour. For example, Benedict's Zuni were described as being free of war, homicide, and concern with accumulation of wealth. Children were not disciplined. Sex was casual, with little concern for virginity, sexual possessiveness, or paternity confidence. Contemporary Western societies are, of course, the opposite of these idyllic paradises. And Benedict suggests that we should study such cultures in order to pass judgment on the dominant traits of our own civilization. Both of these ethnographic accounts have been subjected to devastating criticisms. Warfare and warriors were ignored, and cultures were conceived as consisting of myth-makers and gift-givers. Arans shows that Mead systematically ignored cases of rape, violence, revolution, and competition in her account of Samoa, and the result was a pacified past and an attitude of self-reproach, in which the behaviour of primitive peoples was bowdlerised, while the behaviour of European peoples was not only excoriated as uniquely evil, but also as responsible for all extant examples of warfare among primitive peoples. From this perspective, it is only the fundamental inadequacy of European culture that prevents an idyllic world free from between group conflict. This is where we get this white guilt from, and wouldn't the world be so much better without any white people in it? It all originates from here, I think.
I think it's also where you get the phenomenon of a lot of young white people wanting to go to generally third world countries, traveling, basically in order to, I don't know, confirm the conviction that's already been instilled in them, that Western society is all messed up, and that the third world people are, they've got their heads screwed on. They value, and this is not wholly false. I mean, there are problems in the West, you know, like people get obsessed with making money and working all the time, forget, you know, to spend time with their families. There's various illnesses like that. But people, you know, I think the tosh that Mead in, you know, promoted through that book about the Samoans is connected to that feeling that if you go and visit, you know, Kenya, Cambodia, whatever, you're going to see the more authentic life and so on and so on. And, you know, it all fits with this idea, this sort of general rejection of the West as just, you know, profoundly sick and dying in a lot of people's minds. And that the third world are, you know, basically superior people, despite the material evidence.
And it's all on Hollywood and on the television as well. I think Andrew Anglin went to the Philippines because he was going to live like a savage for some time. And then it was when he was living among these people, he realized, well, I'm different to these people and I'm missing my own people. And that was the start of him waking up to race and nationalism and all the rest of it. I mean, I used to think similar myself. Everybody's been through this same brainwashing, and that this is where it came from, this Boasian anthropology. By 1968, Jews constituted 20% of the faculty of elite American colleges and universities, and constituted 30% of the most liberal faculty. At this time, Jews represented less than 3% of the population, yet they constituted 25% of the social science faculty at elite universities and 40% of liberal faculty who actually published the most. So almost half of the liberal faculty that published the most, they were Jews. You know, this link with the publishers and the universities, this is the way that it's done. And I've got some comments here on Stephen Jay Gould as well. Gould makes the amazing argument that he will continue to ignore all recent scholarship on IQ in favour of the older classical research because of the transient and ephemeral nature of contemporary scholarship. And this is the most recent example of this mentality, is this Stephen Jay Gould, who is looked up to by the mainstream media, but not looked up to by the other scientists. Thus, Gould continues to denigrate studies linking brain size with IQ, despite a great deal of contrary research, both prior to and especially since his 1981 updated book. Gould has convinced the public he is not merely a great writer, but a great theorist of evolution. Yet among top-flight evolutionary biologists, Gould is considered a pest, not just a lightweight, but an actively muddled man who has warped the public's understanding of Darwinism. The point here is that Gould's career of intellectual dishonesty has not existed in a vacuum, but has been part and parcel of a wide-ranging movement that has dominated the most prestigious intellectual arenas in the United States and the West, a movement that is here conceptualized in this book as a facet of Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy. And I can remember reading a book by Stephen Jay Gould about 10 or 15 years ago, just because it was being recommended in all the mainstream newspapers. I think it was in The Guardian that I read that it was being recommended, and I got these books out from the library, these books on evolution. So you can see how far this has managed to make its way, you know, to right the way through society, to everybody being told that these are the guys that you should be reading, these are the ideas that you should have, and yet he's considered a pest amongst biologists.
Yeah, it sounds like he had very little standing intellectually. It was excellent at essentially turning a section of the public against the genuine intellectuals. That's how it sounds to me. Sort of inciting a kind of, not a mob, not a violent mob, although there were occasions where there was, I think it was it Hans Eysenck or Arthur Janssen, one of the biologists. Eysenck himself is part Jewish as well, but by all accounts, an honest scientist. One of those two, you know, was a proponent of what essentially would lead to race realism. I mean, these are just as far as I know, these are just humble scientists, like earnestly pursuing their work, coming to conclusions that would be conducive towards race realism, which is no surprise to you and I. And there were communist students. It became a thing, I think, from the 60s onwards for communist students to basically just terrorize honest academics. And Stephen Jay Gould, I don't know if he led them, but he certainly made sort of joking approval of what they did, which was assaulting people as they were trying to make lectures. And his even more like, I mean, Gould was a Marxist, brought up, you know, by communists in his family. A communist friend I used to have didn't know anything about evolution really, but he chose Stephen Jay Gould as his favourite evolutionary biologist, because he was a Marxist and because he came to tabula rasa conclusions, basically. But by all accounts, Richard Levontin, who is the even, I don't know if he's still alive, I think he's dead, but he was the even more doctrinaire Marxist. And there's one quote, if we've got time, which just illustrates his sort of politicized view of science. I can just find this quote.
Do you want to just look it up? I'll just say something here. I mean, you really don't imagine that scientists are going to be political in any way. You think that
it's the one thing that should be excluded.
Yeah. And yet we discover through this that they're actually political activists, and they're really motivated by Marxism and leftism, and they see their scientific career as a way to promote that, not a way to discover the way the world really works.
Yeah, I mean, MacDonald describes exactly that here. He says, participation in a scientific culture can be used to advance Jewish ethnic interests. The empirical research of Richard Levontin actually uses methods condemned by the extreme methodological purism with which he has opposed several evolutionary and biological approaches to human behaviour. It's interesting in this regard that Levontin appears to be aware that participation in a truly scientific culture creates a, quote, bank account of legitimacy, which we can then spend on our political and humanist pursuits, humanist meaning Marxist. Levontin has therefore established a reputation in a real scientific community and then used that reputation to advance his ethnic agenda, part of which is to insist on a methodological rigour that is incompatible with social science. Even real science can be converted into political currency. I just thought that is a crystalline example of someone just, I mean, very frankly, just saying we can use this science thing, this goyish science thing, for our own ends.
Of course, then you've got the funding as well for all of this, and you're not going to get the funding if you're going to be looking into a taboo subject. You know, if you're going to be looking at, I don't know, gender studies in ancient Egypt, you're going to get loads of money. But if you're going to be looking at IQ differences between Nigeria and China, you're going to get nothing. You're going to have to fund that yourself.
And you're going to have to fend for yourself physically, because you'll be under some physical threat as well.
Yeah, quite severe physical threat in some cases. Well, I did want to just have a quick look at Jewish involvement in the psychoanalytic movement as well, which is actually also known as the Jewish science. So, I mean, that is how Jewish psychoanalytics
are. I didn't
know that. it's also referred to as the Jewish science. And, of course, it was started by Freud. I've got a summary of it here. The familiar caricature of the bearded and monocled Freudian analyst probing his reclining patient for memories of toilet training gone awry and parentally directed lust is now an anachronism as is the professional practice of that most empty and confabulatory art, how such an elaborate theory could have become so widely accepted on the basis of no systematic evidence or critical experiments, and in the face of chronic failures of therapeutic intervention in all of the major classes of mental illness, schizophrenia, mania, depression, etc., is something that sociologists of science and popular culture have yet to fully explain. That's from Paul Churchland in 1995. In 1906, all 17 members of the psychoanalytic movement were Jewish, and they strongly identified as Jews, and that's a quote from Klein in 1981. In a 1971 study, Henry, Sims and Spray found that 62% of their sample of American psychoanalysts identified themselves as having a Jewish cultural affinity. So we can see that this one was probably more Jewish than all the others, and it's affected everything. And I think McDonald really sums it up with what he has to say about it. He says, boys who had succeeded in killing their fathers and then having sex with their mothers would not only be left with genetically inferior offspring, but would also be deprived of paternal support and protection. And that sums up the whole theory of psychoanalysis. And I mean, it's an evolutionary dead end. Physically, it's impossible. It's false. It's completely false. And yet, how many times do you hear Sigmund Freud spoken of as being a great scientist or a great hero? You never hear of him being criticized in the mainstream media. And he knew that what he was bringing was going to be harmful to the non-Jews. He even said that when he went to America. He said, I'm bringing the plague with me. Little do they know. And all the yeah. same things we saw in these other movements as well, where they got non-Jews to be frontmen, and they got worried that there were too many Jews and we need to get some non-Jews in here. And then the publishers getting hold of it and promoting it, and then the media. It's the same thing again and again and again with these movements. I don't see how anyone can disprove Kevin McDonald's thesis, to be honest. What are your thoughts on this, Horace?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent quote, the one you just read out. And it's probably not unrelated as well that Freud was, what, the uncle of Edward Bernays, or closely related to Edward Bernays, who was, if anyone wants to watch the documentary Century of the Self by Adam Curtis, you can find out more about Edward Bernays, or just read his work, obviously. But he was, I can't remember what his famous book was. Was it Public Relations? He was an innovator in marketing. Not in a good way, really. Like, I mean, he did sell a lot of products, but at the expense of basically deceiving and tricking people into thinking that smoking was cool and this and that, you know. Basically, yeah, I mean, the idea of cool probably has some roots in Bernays' work as well. You know, making vices glamorous. I'm sure, you know, the thinking that made Edward Bernays such a successful marketer was probably, you know, part of the cultural melee in which Freud grew up as well. And the fact that he saw himself as bringing a virus or a bacillus or something to America when he first crossed the Atlantic, I mean, that says a lot about this sort of mixture of, I mean, you cited Tik and Olam. There are people, you know, especially rabbis who seem to take the idea of Tik and Olam seriously. I think also, of course, it serves as a pretext for sanctimony about something that's actually really malevolent. And I can imagine Freud, you know, very frequently, despite having said that to his friend, you know, we're bringing this virus or whatever, we're bringing this disease, or we're going to infect them. He probably, you know, in front of other audiences, presented what he was doing as very, very noble and very helpful to mankind, you know, part of Tikkun Olam in a way. You know, it's that mixture of sanctimony and malevolence seems to be uniquely Jewish, or unique to Jewish activists. And I think it's apt. I don't know whether you meant to, but when you said psychoanalysis, I think that is a fitting, you know, it's fitting to call it an ism rather than, you know, a genuine field of study. What I do know of Freud, which is not, you know, I've not got a brilliant knowledge of him, but what I do know, I think it really seems fitting that one of his books was called Civilization and Its Discontents. And that was, I think, later in his career that he wrote that, after probably what may have been some time of genuine discovery. I'm not sure, you know, how seriously he was actually trying to do any good. But Civilization and Its Discontents, as I understand it from a synopsis, argues that basically mankind is, or the West really, civilization, he probably means, you know, white countries, the West, is suffering because it's not being honest with itself, i.e. it's not going through psychoanalysis, i.e. the whole of the West needs me, i.e. I am the rabbi of the whole Western world, in a way. And they all need to look up to me. I am the light unto their nations, you know. Yeah, obviously that's a good way of getting rich if you can convince people of that as well. Rich, powerful, influential, lots of sex, and so on and so on. Well,
I was just going to say that he did see Jews as being superior because they were not sexually repressed. They did not restrain their sexual urges. So his idea would have been that the West is far too repressive and they need the Jews to tell them that, you know, you don't need to get married before you have sex. You can have free sex. You can have homosexual sex. And this grew into the sexual revolution. And there's an interesting crossover here with E. Michael Jones when he looks at this. And he says that what they were doing, they were replacing the confession to a priest, when you would confess to a priest and then you would do penitence, with confessing to a psychoanalyst who you would pay, who would then give you permission to continue in what you were doing and say that it was okay. So you got like a symmetry.
It's a profoundly different thing. Yeah, it's a profound transformation. An inversion. Again, it's an inversion. It's what was supposed to be serviceable to you, and depending on, you know, how faithful you are, like what is a good relationship with God, you know, in the confession box, in a way. I mean, you're talking to a man, but, you know, you're supposed to be sort of giving up your confession to God in a way. It's replacing that with giving up your confession to someone who's definitely just a person and who is a person with material interests in your being there. And with ethnic interests and so on and so on. So, yeah, it's such, whilst making you feel like you're still doing a good thing or a healthy thing, that's, again, that's quintessentially Jewish, inverting what we think to be good to make it useful to them instead.
Well, the other thing is, looking at it from the point of view of the Jew, you know, it's their equivalent of what we're doing is wrong. What they're doing is right. That's the way people are supposed to be, is the way that the Jews are. I'm sure they see it like that. I don't think they see what they're doing as wrong in any way. I mean, they're confused why the Gentiles don't want to be like them and behave like them. They don't understand it. And the more I study this, the more I see it, it's like a symmetry, like a reflection. They're like a reflection of us. And we actually learn a lot about ourselves by looking at them and basically saying, well, we shouldn't be behaving like that. And they do the same. They look at us and say, we shouldn't be behaving like that. And this is what Freud was doing. He was saying, this is alien to Jews. Jews don't think that we should be behaving like they do in the West with morality. We think we should be behaving in the opposite way. And we're here to liberate you non-Jews. And that this is where this friction comes from, I think. And I've pointed this out to others before. We judge their behavior. And in actual fact, if their behavior is serving them, and it is serving them, that, you know, they've got more influence now than they've ever had before. The Jews are in a better position now than they've ever been before in history. So their behavior is serving them. So I can't judge them and say their behavior is wrong, because their behavior is good for them. But it's not right for us. And they serve as teachers to us of how we should behave, which is not like them, basically. Do you want to add anything to that, Horace?
Yeah, I'll agree with you once again on this. Yeah, I mean, it's us who, as much as we may not want to, I think it's, you know, like the sort of adaptability to new ethnic conditions is something that a lot of whites resist, and I understand it. I feel that myself. I don't really want us to change. Nevertheless, it is a question of survival, and we need to. We may never adapt in the way that Jews do. Jews seem to be incredibly flexible in a lot of ways, in the way that they'll change to stay the same, as it were, whereas we just think that we can stay the same really without any adaptability, and we have to learn, like, for, you know, our survival is on the line. We have to learn that we have to adapt, whether we find it undignified or whatever. We just have to, because otherwise we cannot confront the enemies that we have now.
Yeah, we certainly have to adapt to the conditions that we are in today. It's no good just sitting here and complaining about it. We have to adapt and get back on top again. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Horace. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with the final episode of our Culture of Critique series. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.